Hello and welcome to the Leeds Like Blues podcast. You're joining me, your host, Brother Matt Namiria, and with me tonight,
Brother Josh Doxey Turnbull,
Brother Matthew Wharton,
Brother Dean Leach,
Worshipful Brother Andrew Polviak,
and Worshipful Brother Tony Harvey.
Worshipful Brother Tony, thank you very much for coming along and joining us.
Thank you guys, it's really good to be invited.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, my word. Okay, well, so I'm Tony, born and brought up in the southeast. Became a Freemason about 30 years ago, and largely through scouting, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. Became very enthused about Freemasonry and got involved with various things. Did a lot of jobs in my local province, a lot of roles. Ended up being the Prestonian lecturer for 2012 with my title Scouting and Freemasonry, two parallel organisations. Always the question mark. You've got to have the question mark. Got involved also in membership development and came up with the idea for the members pathway and have spent the last 6 years developing that and involved with the charities as well. Right now in lockdown, spending a lot of time developing, writing, delivering lectures over Zoom, and I'm working on a book.
Excellent. No, that's really good. And tonight we're going to be focusing a lot about what you've been doing, Tony, and certainly over lockdown, what was going on. But before we go any further, brethren, let's first of all raise a glass and toast the Queen and the Craft.
The Queen and the Craft.
Queen and the Craft.
The Queen and the Craft.
The Queen and the Craft.
I'm loving that Tony Harvey is using a firing glass at the moment just for our listeners.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes. Lodge of Faith in Brightlingsea. There we go.
Very good. Very good. So, just really, while we're on the topic of toasts, there's two other toasts that we do. And first is to the visitors, or our guests rather, that we have on the Facebook page. So the rules are simple. If you like us on our Facebook, you get a shout out on the podcast. So we've had two new likes this week, and they are Matthew W. St. Werberger and Wayne Newsom. So, brethren, let's raise a glass to our guests.
To our guests.
Welcome. We're also on Twitter. You can go check us out, www.twitter.com/LeedsLikeBlues. We're also on Twitch, twitch.tv/LeedsLikeBlues. Go check us out. So, Tony, one of the things that we do on this show is it is customary when we have a new guest, we ask them what their three most memorable lodges are. So, what are they? No pressure.
You know, Matt, I'm so glad you gave me the heads up on this one, because this is... I've been to so many. Do you know, I've visited every province in this country. I've delivered my Prestonian in every province in this country. And just thinking back over this, there's so many lodges that come to mind. I'm a member of some really memorable lodges. And sometimes I've joined memorable lodges because I've liked them so much. But if I think, you know, if I stick to the rules, you talked about visiting. So lodges that I'm not a member of that really stand out in my mind. And the top three I've come up with are the following. The first one is the oldest lodge in our constitution. Lodge of Antiquity, number two. The lodge was one of the four that founded the Grand Lodge, the first Grand Lodge in 1717. It was supposedly the one, well, it was the one that had been involved in the building of St. Paul's Cathedral. It has Sir Christopher Wren's Mall. It's steeped in history, and it's just a fantastic lodge to visit. And I was really privileged because I was invited to deliver my Prestonian to the lodge by David Williamson, who was at the time the assistant Grand Master and was in the chair of the lodge. And this, of course, is one of our Red Apron lodges. It wasn't a large group. The number of people attending is relatively small, but it was just so well run. This is one of our oldest lodges, our oldest lodge. It has great traditions and it has great history, and yet it's so smoothly and so slickly run. There's no messing around. There's no faffing about, as I call it. And everything is done so smoothly. And the labour and refreshment, the balance between the two, the work in the temple and then an excellent festive board at the Garrick, they were so welcoming. And I met people there on that night that have since become good friends. And actually, you know, when I look back over it, it was the trigger to get me involved in the RMTGB, the Royal Masonic Trust for Girls and Boys. So a lot of good things came out of that. And Right Worshipful Brother David Williamson was such a generous and kind host. And it was just a high point in my memory. So that was number one, or rather lodge number two, Lodge of Antiquity number two. And then, you know, I was thinking, there's so many I could talk about. You know, when I do a Prestonian, I actually write a sort of diary entry, a memoir, just for my own sake, really. And so I read back over a number of those. But my second one was not to do with the Prestonian at all, except that it came about The lodge was founded because of my Prestonian. And it's Scoutcraft Lodge number 9936 in Bristol. So it's one of, you know, I've gone from our oldest lodge to one of our newer ones. Scoutcraft came about. I delivered my Prestonian to Bristol Installed Masters, and it really generated an interest in, for Bristol to have its own scouting lodge. It's quite a big lodge. It's in the 40s, maybe even more now. Being a Bristol lodge, it has all the Bristol workings, and they're quite unique. They're different from any other province. Bristol is allowed to do things that we can't do anywhere else, and it's delivered in such a special way. It's a high standard of ritual in Bristol. So I've been a number of times. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to get to the consecration, which really disappointed me. But I'm on the sort of permanently invited guest list, and I go whenever I can. And when you go there, it's just such a warm, friendly environment. There's the scouting blend as well as the Masonic, but it's all within that Bristol framework. If you've never, ever been to a Bristol lodge, please, please, please go. The initiation has features which are just fantastic. And if you're an installed master, the installation ceremony involves all the installed masters going into a separate room. Again, unlike anything else in our constitution. I love Bristol. I love Bristol Freemasonry. And for me, having a scouting lodge in Bristol brings two of the great things together. So it's a young lodge, and you know, go along and visit them if you can. Scoutcraft Lodge number 9936.
It sounds fascinating, Tony. So what's your number three?
Well, number three, I've got to include this lodge in it. And it's another scouting lodge, so forgive me for that. And, you know, I thought about lodges overseas, and I thought about lodges in London, and there's all sorts of quirky things about different lodges. But I had to go with Indaba Lodge, number 9454, in Darlington, province of Durham. It's another scouting lodge. And the thing about the guys in Indaba, you know, I'm not a member. My daughter's boyfriend's a member, and they are just so close as a lodge. They're tight-knit, they're warm and friendly, they're a real family, and I feel a real part of that family. So I go and visit them whenever I can. Their ritual is not quite the same as Lodge of Antiquity or Bristol. It's a bit different. And you know, they're not as slick, but they are genuinely just so embracing. And every visitor that they bring on board, every visitor that attends is just embraced by this family that is up there. And they're all scouters, of course, so that gives us another close bond. And one of the great things about the lodge is every year they have a white table for ladies, and my wife comes along and she's just as welcomed and loved by everybody. You know, if the lodge was down the road, there's no doubt I'd be a member. So it's just that warmth and that scouting bond again, and the sheer friendliness just stands out for me. Wow. I could talk about lots of others, but there we go. They're the ones that stand out in the memory.
Well, that's absolutely excellent. And I'm sure on behalf of all of your lodges, let's raise a glass. So to Tony's Lodges.
I love how you've covered the entire breadth of the country there as well, which is, you know, you've really put some consideration into that, as well as having quite special lodges to you. So yeah, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Matthew. It wasn't easy, because there are some, I mean, locally there's some, you know, near where I live in Derbyshire, and most of my, well, all my provincial roles except one has been in Derbyshire. You know, I'm very close to a number of lodges here, as well as being a member of a lot of lodges. So there's a lot more that I could have talked about, and some really special ones in London as well. But these are the ones I went with. So yeah.
Am I correct in saying that the Lodge of Antiquity doesn't actually meet with a warrant, or is that an incorrect statement?
No, you're absolutely right. Because there was no Grand Lodge, there was no authority to issue a warrant.
Mm.
So they meet under time immemorial, they meet without a warrant. So and the same is true for the other two of the surviving lodges that together founded the Premier Grand Lodge.
Interestingly, we have a lodge in Leeds who, certainly in season one of this podcast, any local visitors that we had on, it always seemed to be one of the top three or most memorable lodges, the Lodge of Fidelity, number 289. And their numbers changed somewhat over time. However, I believe they actually started out without a warrant. And then when Grand Lodge was formed, they then thought, well, seeing as we've been operating for this long, we might as well get a warrant now. It's absolutely fascinating, really, especially the older lodges. It's the ones that are that steeped in history that you find out actually consecrated other lodges as well.
Yes.
You know, it's fascinating, really.
Some of the earlier lodges didn't have, you know, before they started issuing warrants, before the Grand Lodge started issuing warrants, they were simply founded by the Grand Master showing up. And if you like, you know, the fact that his presence gave them the authority to meet. And so, you know, they were constituted, not consecrated. Wow. And, you know, some of these lodges, not all of them, but some of them are Red Apron lodges now. And you see on their summons, you know, constituted rather than consecrated.
That's fascinating. Is the Grand Master still the worshipful master of the Lodge of Antiquity permanently, or is that not
yes.
true?
No, it is true, and it's only recent. It's only since the tercentenary in 2017, and it's the case that he is the permanent master of the three time immemorial lodges. And so what those lodges do is they have a deputy master who's elected every year, and for all intents and purposes, the deputy master is like a normal master in another lodge. It's a bit similar to having a program master in Grand Lodge who steps in and fulfills the function of the Grand Master when he's not available.
It's knitting stuff. It's just so, very different quirks of lodges and things, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. And it's part of the fun of Freemasonry, I think.
Yeah.
It's the exceptions, you know, the anomalies and so forth, yeah.
Tony, can you tell us a little bit about the Bristol lodges then, if they're slightly different, why they're different, without giving anything away?
First of all, it's the history. It's a province, but it's the only province which is found where all the lodges meet in one place. So it's a city that is also a province. And of course, because of all its trading, there were, in the early days of Freemasonry, a lot of people coming in and out of Bristol. So Bristol was a sort of hub of a lot of developments in Freemasonry, with people coming in and bringing new ideas and degrees and things in and out of the country through Bristol. Thomas Dunkley was very involved with Bristol, and he developed a lot of our different aspects of rituals and degrees and so forth. And so he was the first provincial Grand Master, if I understand correctly, of Bristol. And then over the years, Bristol has, you know, basically people in Bristol have said when the Royal Arch Chapter stopped doing the ceremony of the veils, Bristol asked if they could restore it. And they got permission just over 100 years ago to do it. So it's the only province which, as part of their Royal Arch ceremony, or as part of the lead into it before the Royal Arch ceremony of exaltation, they do the ceremony of the veils. But the craft ceremonies themselves are different in the sense that, I mean, you'd recognise 90% of it, but there are elements that they do, there's aspects that they do that you wouldn't see anywhere else. And there's, you know, there's one particular element which everybody is told to look out for, but not told what it is when they go and visit an initiation in Bristol. And I won't give it away on here, obviously, but it's worth going to Bristol just to see an initiation with this extra element, which makes complete sense. You know, you'll always remember it. The lodge rooms in Bristol are great. If you just Google Bristol Masonic Hall, it's a fantastic building. It was bombed out during the war and rebuilt. They have something called the Baldwin Rite, which brings together the chivalric degrees under one system. And so you have, again, I'm not an expert on this, but you have effectively the provincial prior is also the inspector general of the Rose Croix, rather, ancient accepted rite. And they're much more integrated in that sense. And because they all lodges meet in the one place, there's a real bond between them. I was particularly impressed with the installation ceremony. And the fact that, you know, all the installed masters go into a separate room and do a sort of form of ritual that you don't see anywhere else. Lots of things which are quite special, quite different, quite unique, and well worth a visit if you can get along to Bristol. When we can, you know, whenever that's going to be.
I've got two further questions on that then, please, Johnny. First one, when you said there's something in the initiation that's really good for us to go to revisit, is that any initiation in a Bristol lodge? And the second thing is, on installation, when masters or past masters go into another side room, are you like rabbits in a headlight? You don't know what's going on because you've never done it yourself as well.
Two great questions. Thanks, Andy. Regarding the initiation, is it everyone? Yes, because every lodge in Bristol uses the same ritual. And there's an expectation that it's delivered without the book. And there's, you know, there's a high expectation of the standard of ritual there. And people meet it because, you know, they know that it's special to Bristol and nobody wants to let their lodge down within that. So people put the work in. So yes, every lodge in Bristol uses the same ritual and therefore does that form of the initiation ceremony. Coming on to your second question there about the, yes, when you've not done it before and you don't know that you're going to be going off, as you say, it's exactly that. It's a side room. It's a bit like being a candidate in another ceremony yourself, because you don't know what to expect. You don't know what's going to happen. You don't know how it's going to function. But like any other ceremony, you go with the flow and you follow what other people are doing. And it's not so different that you don't recognize where you are. It's just done in a particularly special way. I think it's a very nice form of the installation ceremony. I don't want to say too much about installation for those people who are not installed masters, but it's a very nice way of doing the installation.
So bringing it back around to yourself and obviously your experience in Freemasonry, the one thing that everyone who's heard of you will know is that you are a former Bristolian lecturer, the 2012 Bristolian lecturer. So let's talk a little bit more about that. So first of all, for our listeners, what is a Bristolian lecturer and how do you become one?
Well, I can answer the first one. I'm not certain I can answer the second. Let's have a go. I mean, first of all, a Bristolian lecturer is an annual appointment made by Grand Lodge. It's the only Masonic lectureship sponsored by United Grand Lodge. So it's a big thing. It's a big deal. There are other Masonic lectureships sponsored by provinces. This is the only one sponsored by Grand Lodge. And it's the oldest Masonic lectureship in the world. It's named after William Preston. William Preston was a really big guy in the 18th century in terms of Freemasonry. He was an educator, but he was also really, really good at promoting his work and drew a lot of attention to it. He developed what we now call the craft lectures, or the lectures as demonstrated by the Emulation Lodge of Improvement. He did the early work on developing those. And when he died, he was quite a character. At one point, he was kicked out of Grand Lodge, and then 10 years later he was admitted back. So he was controversial at times, but when he died he left a sum of money to the Grand Master, actually, and he died in 1818, and the sum of money was so that the Grand Master could appoint each year a lecturer to deliver Preston's own lectures. I mean, what a wonderful marketing system. This guy really knew how to market things. I mean, earlier on he'd written a book called Illustrations of Masonry, which is a fantastic book even now to read to sort of ground you in what was happening in Freemasonry in the time. And he put on a big show of Freemasonry that he invited all the great and the good to. So this guy knew how to put things together and how to promote them. So coming back to his death and the establishment of the lectureship, from 1820 onwards, there was an annual appointment of a Prestonian lecturer. And at first, it was literally people delivering Preston's own lectures, or one of them. And that carried on into, you know, much later into the 19th century. And then it sort of died down a bit, really. It was resurrected in 1924. And since then, the person appointed has been asked to deliver his own lecture. It has to be original. So it's his own lecture on a Masonic subject of his own choosing, to educate and entertain a General Lodge audience. So it's not an academic paper. It's got to be something that is of wide appeal within Freemasonry. A lot of them have been history related over the years when you look at the list. And there's a list at the back of the Grand Lodge yearbook. Once you're a Prestonian lecturer, incidentally, I'm not a former Prestonian lecturer. I am a Prestonian lecturer. I'm not the current one. So it's a sort of status that stays with you. And your name's in the book forever. It's quite a big thing. You know, it's very prestigious. It's a great honour. I was quite amazed when I was told that I was going to be a Prestonian lecturer. So,
how do you get that call? What's it like to receive the call telling you you're going to be a Prestonian lecturer?
Well, I'll tell you my story, because, you know, everyone has their own sort of version of how they told that they were asked to do it. In my case, what had happened, I'd already started doing talks about scouting and Freemasonry, and I was doing that on behalf of the Kindred Lodges Association. And it was because I had a role sort of liaising between scouting and Freemasonry. And that role had already taken me to meeting with the Grand Secretary. I'd been introduced to the Grand Secretary. I'd started a sequence of meetings between the Grand Secretary and the Chief Exec of the Scouts. And those meetings carry on, you know, they tend to be lunchtime meetings, or they have been lunchtime meetings a couple of times a year. And I delivered a talk to a particular lodge, and present at the lodge was someone who subsequently told me he'd nominated me to be a Prestonian lecturer. wow, I thought, that's pretty good. Never expected that. And thought nothing of it for a while. And then I was in conversation with John Hamill, asked him some questions about it. And he said, well, yes, you're on the list. So not only had I been nominated, but he basically confirmed that I will be at some point in the future. So we chatted about it, and I asked him lots of questions. And I put it really to the back of my mind, because the conversation was in about 2010, and he said it would be a few years yet. And I thought, well, that's fine, because I've got a few things to do. I was provincial grand mentor for Derbyshire. I was director of communications for a festival that finished in 2014. I thought, well, after that, it'll be really quite good. And then I was at a meeting where the Grand Secretary was present, and he called me over to the side and over a coffee and said, have you had our letter yet? Now, when the Grand Secretary asks you whether you've had a letter from Grand Lodge, you know, all sorts of things go through your mind, really. No, what letter is that? And apparently they'd written to appoint me or offer me the appointment, and I'd not received it. He said, well, basically in 3 days' time, everybody's going to get the paper of business for quarterly communication saying that you've been appointed as the Prestonian lecturer. And I said, well, for when? What year? He said, well, next year. And this was the end of May 2011. And so, oh my God. So I had to sort of do a bit of fast footwork, really. I had to do all my research and write the book. And the last thing I did was actually write the lecture. I wrote the book first. Did all the research for that, and that took quite a lot. And in the last month before the last month of the year, I literally put some slides together that became the talk. And the talk itself is done without notes. The slides, you know, carry me through it. But the book is the gospel, as it were, the full text. It's not, the book isn't the lecture. The book is much more than the lecture, but it's the full text on the subject. So, Matt, I've probably answered more questions than I should have done there.
No, not at all. No, it's not every day you get a Prestonia lecturer on our podcast. And so, you know, we are humble to have you here, and it's absolutely fantastic. So anything, you know, you could tell us is excellent. I'm sure our listeners as well are equally as curious. Obviously, you get the call. You're going to be the Prestonian lecturer. You go around the country. You visit all the provinces giving and delivering this lecture. So they don't just send you off on your own, do they? They also give you something to take away with you.
Yeah, they do. Actually, to some extent, you are off on your own. But let me explain that. When you're appointed and it's announced in Grand Lodge that you've been appointed, what then happens is that lodges are invited to apply for the privilege of hosting an official delivery of the Prestonian lecture. And there's three or four official deliveries each year. There's always one in London. Often there's one overseas. And so lodges write in, they're approved, and then it's up to me to set the date with that lodge to make it convenient. They're the official deliveries, but there's also an unofficial. So we've got free rein to deliver the lecture unofficially to any lodge in the world, any recognised lodge in the world. I did my three in my year, one of which was one of my own lodges, Authors Lodge, number 3456. Another one was Humber Masters Lodge in North and East Yorkshire. Not too far from you guys, or rather Yorkshire North and East Ridings, I should say. Mm-hmm. And the other was North Knots Masters Lodge in Nottinghamshire. So they were the three official. And as far as Grand Lodge was concerned, if I only did the three, I'd have met the requirements. But we're all able to do as many as we wish. I've actually done 122 now.
Wow.
I did 30-odd. Wow. I can't quite remember the number. I did 30-odd in that first year, including the 30 took me literally around the country. And as far as you guys are concerned, I did Leeds Installed Masters. So that's, you know, that was close to you. But since then, and over the course of those years, I've delivered it in every province in our country, in a number of provinces more than once. I've delivered it in a number of districts overseas and in other jurisdictions overseas as well. And we've raised just shy, literally £100-something shy of £80,000 for charity.
That's absolutely fantastic.
Well done, Tony.
Brilliant. Yeah.
But there is a permanent memento of this. When you get the letter of appointment, it tells you that you are entitled, or the Grand Master has granted permission for the Prestonian lecturer to wear a distinctive collarette and jewel with his craft regalia. It's quite specific. It's only with my craft regalia. It's a round jewel on a narrow dark blue ribbon. And when you are the Prestonian lecturer, you wear a pierced jewel. And then at the end of your year, you hand back the pierced jewel. It's passed on to your successor, and you're given your own permanent jewel, which isn't see-through, isn't pierced. It's solid at the back. And I've worn it ever since with my craft regalia.
That's quite nice, actually, because it's nice to know that your name's down in the book somewhere, but it's also nice to have something to kind of show for it as well. That's a nice touch.
Yeah, and I mean, at any one time, there's only, you know, about 20 of us alive because, you know, obviously the obvious happens. So it's a real distinction, and there's not too many collarettes in craft masonry. So it's a very nice touch, a great privilege and a great honour.
I was going to ask, obviously, since lockdown, you've done a whole bunch of remote lectures, including a couple for us, which we are most grateful for. But since then, you've expanded into the world of YouTube.
Yeah, yes, I have.
So if anyone wants to go and see your Fristonian lecture and can't find a live date available, where can they go to see recordings?
So, yeah, it's interesting this because, I mean, thanks to you guys, I started doing online talks. And no doubt we'll talk more about that in a bit. And then people started saying, well, is it recorded? Is it online? Can I go and see it online? And I didn't really want to put them up online because there's always a fear, and I'm not the only one to think this, that if people see your talk online, then they won't come to the live event. And, you know, the great thing about the live event is that even virtually, you're still meeting people. And over the course of all this time that I've been doing Masonic talks, not just this year, but going back over the almost 10 years now, it's the people I've met that has made it special. Delivering a talk, you know, my Prestonian 122 times, what makes it come alive for me is the different reactions and the different stories and the different connections that people have with the subject. And the question and answer session is, I think, the thing I really love the best, where I feel challenged, you know. And so I was really concerned about putting stuff up on YouTube. And then I thought, well, no, actually, you know, if you want to build your audience, if you want to get your message across, if you want more people to hear what you've got to say, the Scouting and Freemasonry one, I am actively trying to promote a relationship at all levels between Scouting and Freemasonry. So why would I not put that up on YouTube? So I decided to start putting my talks up on YouTube, but without the Q&A session. So the Q&A without the Q&A session means that what people get is they get the talk, and in most cases it's a talk recorded live for a group like yourself, and that recording therefore has got all the ums and ahs and so forth. But by taking out the Q&A session, it's just the talk, and I'm hoping therefore that people will still want to come in for a live talk with the Q&A and to have that engagement. Still early days, so, you know, I may be taking a risk, I don't know, but I think it's really important to get the content out there for people to see it.
I think in terms of taking the risk, it's not a big risk to be taken, Tony, in our opinion. I mean, I think it's safe to say, guys, isn't it, that you've got the Masonic Roundtable, they've got plenty of stuff on their YouTube, educational stuff, and yet it's still an absolute pleasure to invite people along and to, you know, actually have that engagement and involvement, because you can watch all the videos you like, but it's the questions that people have that make you want to be there live.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you asked how they can get hold of it. My YouTube channel is Worshipful Brother Tony Harvey. Nice. So just look for that YouTube channel. And my website has got links to it as well. The website is prestonian2012.org.uk. The website is mainly about Masonic talks and articles. I do a little bit of a blog to say what I've been up to and what I'm doing, but mostly to promote the talks. So you can go on there and there's a direct link across to the YouTube channel.
I must admit, Tony, you've really inspired me with some of the stuff that you've said, especially about the 7 habits of highly successful lodges, and also a discussion that we had. So I've actually written a short paper on Freemasonry and how it can actually help self-improvement, especially with moving from the character ethic in the 1920s to nowadays, where people more or less look at the personality ethic and are more centered around that. But we were putting together a lodge proposal. And as part of our principles for this new lodge, we looked at the 7 principles of highly successful lodges. And we slightly expanded on that to include 9. And 9 seemed to fit very nicely with the working tools. We looked at the chisel for the unrelenting pursuit of ritual and ceremonial excellence. didn't want to seem too elitist, but in other words, to say that as part of a lodge, people should actually look to hone their skills and actually put the effort in for everyone else. The mallet as well, to support new and young members. The gauge, to apply humility and humour. The level, as we all know, to make sure that we're all on the level and we've got no sense of class or rank within the lodge at all. The square, proving that we've all got a willingness to evolve and change. The plum rule, so that we've got higher standards of discipline, so we don't deviate from that line. The pencil, to maintain efficient administration. The compass, to remain in due bounds with everyone and promote harmony and involvement with all the members. And lastly, the skivet, to promote leadership from the chair. That was my take on the seven things. So I just slightly expanded on it, but you really inspired me to look forward and apply these to a lodge that we were proposing.
Dino, that, you know, that is fantastic. I mean, that's really humbling to hear you say that. As well as doing talks about scouting and Freemasonry, most of my talks really are about Freemasonry in the 21st century. And they're about how we manage our lodges to make them attractive, to introduce people, and to make sure that what the lodge delivers is an experience that the 21st century working man wants and responds to. And the first talk I did for you was my talk on the future of Freemasonry, evolution and change, which looks at how Freemasonry has always evolved and how it's necessary for lodges to evolve to survive. The Seven Habits talk was a talk I first wrote in 2010. And I stopped doing it, not because I didn't want to do it anymore, but because other talks sort of took its place, really. And I revisited it a few months ago and I brought it up to date. And since then, I've done all the work on the members pathway and I've done a lot more work on lodge development. So I brought it back up to date and it's proved really successful. People have really clicked onto this. The reason it is Seven Habits is twofold. Number one, there was a book written in the 20th century, you know, 30 so years ago, called Seven Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey. Now, Stephen Covey was, you know, it was a hugely successful book, still selling in its millions, very inspirational, a book that made a big impact on me. And you talked about the character ethic versus the personality ethic. And, you know, Covey reignited the idea of good character, really. But what he was looking at was, what are the common patterns that underline people who seem to be most effective in life? Now, my professional work, I focus on success. And success for me is about achieving our goals. So we're successful if we achieve our goals. And I just translated it over to Freemasonry to look at, well, okay, that's, what are the seven habits of lodges that are successful? And a successful lodge is one that brings people into Freemasonry, keeps them, and is strong and healthy and growing at the level it wants. The other reason for seven is, you know, my academic background and the sort of thinking that underpins a lot of my work is psychology. I'm a psychologist. And there was a really famous paper by a guy called George Miller, a book actually, where he looked at how many items that can we easily recall. And it turned out, you know, the title of his book is The Magic Number 7 plus or minus 2. So if you want to get people to remember things easily, 7 is an optimum number. So, you know, I kept it to the 7. It was faithful to Covey. I'd shared a conference platform with Covey some years ago. I'd met the man and was very impressed and inspired by him. So the fact that you've now taken it and developed it, and I love the way you've turned it into a link with the working tools. I really like that. And the way you've found those themes is absolutely brilliant. You've kept to many of mine, but you've built on it. So that's fantastic. I've got them in front of me, but I need to look at them a little bit more closely. One thing I would say, Dino, is, and this is a really big thing of mine, only use positive language. So if you say to people, don't do this, you're putting in their mind the thing that you don't want them to do. One of your habits is no sense of class or rank. And what you're actually doing is putting in their minds a sense of class or rank. And that's because the brain doesn't think of the absence of anything.
Don't think about elephants.
Yeah, so exactly it. You know, the one I always use is don't think of kangaroos. So if I say to people, don't think of kangaroos, they're probably not thinking of kangaroos in the nanosecond before I say it. Soon as I say it, despite the fact I've said don't think of kangaroos, what are they now thinking of? So when we go around saying, I don't want you to think this, we're actually programming people to think the very thing we don't. So turn it into a positive. So instead of telling them what you don't want, tell them what you do want. But I love that. And, you know, I'd love to have a copy of that, Dean, if you wouldn't mind. The fact that, you know, my talk has been a stepping stone to that development, I think is brilliant. And the fact that it's going to be the founding principles of a lodge, fantastic. You know, is this a lodge that is going to be a new lodge, or is it going to be, are you taking over another one? Or
the proposal's been postponed at the moment simply because of the current situation that we're in.
Okay.
Yeah, it's an aspiration of us as some of the light blues all the way across province to have a peripatetic lodge that's going to visit all five of our areas. We've got 59 different Masonic halls in Yorkshire West Riding, all the way over from Bentham in the Dales to Ripon to Goole to Sheffield. So essentially it's quite a wide area. And so to move around within that, create some lasting memories when we had to go to visit places. And if you can imagine, oh, do you remember the time when we went to Goole and we forgot the tracing boards, so we had to draw them on a piece of paper? You know, and making memories like that, that's the driving force behind it, really.
That's fantastic. I'm founding master of the first ever Scouting Mark Lodge, and that's a travelling lodge. And you're absolutely right, the memories that are stimulated by travelling about. But I love the idea, and please, 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 when you are up and running, please invite me along. I'd love to come along and support you. And who knows, you know, I might be including that lodge in my top three in a podcast in the future.
Thank you, Tony. We'll definitely invite you when we get set up.
Fantastic. Cheers, Dino.
So, Tony, you've talked a little bit about the Prestonian Lecture and its concept and where it's come from and its history. Do you want to talk very briefly about your particular lecture and scouting? Because I know that you've mentioned scouting lodges in two of your three top lodges were also scouting lodges, and you've just mentioned a Mark Lodge as well. So it'd be interesting to hear very briefly about that, really.
Thank you, Matthew. I became a Freemason through scouting. You know, scouting has been a big part of my life. My parents met through scouting, so scouting has been my sort of basis in life, really. Scouting's principles has been my sort of driving force in many ways. And my early interest, my first interest in Freemasonry came about because I knew a number of scouters who were Freemasons and who were telling me that, you know, for people involved with scouting, Freemasonry makes a lot of sense. And so I joined a scouting lodge. I soon got involved with the Kindred Lodges Association, which is the lodge association for all the youth work lodges. And it had asked me to act as a liaison with the scouts. And it was an easy job to do because for me, the parallels are so clear. You know, the values, the principles under which, you know, which sit underneath both of them are exactly the same. There's lots of other features that you find in scouting which have echoes or resonate with Freemasonry. Even the sense of ceremony and ritual, although very different, but the fact that they exist and are an important part of it. So the parallels are really, really strong. And a lot of other people have talked about that. But what nobody had done was look at the future. Everybody who had written on this or did talks about this until me were looking at it as a sort of nostalgia, looking back rather than looking forward. And I love tradition and I love history and I love heritage, but I'm also quite progressive in my thinking. I'm looking at how do we develop for the future? How do we take this forward, make it attractive and relevant for the future? So I got very keen on looking at how scouting and Freemasonry could develop a relationship locally and nationally, and what can we learn from each other? And the key for that really was that I'd been involved with a lot of developments in scouting at a national level, particularly to do with adult training and how we recruit adults and how we build the organisation as something for more and more young people. And I was involved in that work, you know, going back some years now, really. And so I could see what we'd done in scouting and how that could be of real value to Freemasonry. So the message in the Prestonian is, yes, we've got all these tremendous parallels and therefore we're an obvious organisation, two organisations. It's obvious that we should talk to each other. But actually, there's a lot that Freemasonry can learn from the transformation that scouting went through when it made a number of changes that, you know, as I say, I was involved with. And the consequence of those changes was growth in scouting. It's a growing organisation. But an organisation which has held on to its values, its principles, its foundation, its core. And so that's the message of the lecture. You know, we in Freemasonry can also change the way the organisation works, the way our lodges work, the way we function and organise ourselves to be modern organisations without changing our core, our fundamentals, our values, without changing our ritual and so forth. So you've got your core and your meaning, but you've got the way in which you organise yourself. And that's where I was trying to articulate that and to say, let's learn from the Scouts and let's offer the Scouts something in return. We've done a great deal in raising money for the Scouts or granting money for the Scouts to help them grow. But we've also got great facilities and great skills. So the Scouts around the country are making use of some of our fantastic Masonic halls for things like awards evenings, you know, creating an Oscar experience for young people. Getting up on stage and getting their badge in a really splendid Masonic hall is an experience that is memorable for young people. But also the skills that we've got in Freemasonry, the people that we've got, have got so much to offer for scouting. So it was, for me, it was an obvious thing to try to facilitate building those relationships nationally between the leaders, but also locally. That work continues.
Thanks, Tony. I think it's a really interesting subject. And what is fascinating is that you've taken the basis of that lecture and you've kind of expanded it into multiple other lectures and studies, and obviously you wrote the membership pathway on behalf of Grand Lodge, which is now being implemented across the country, and other things. Do you want to touch upon the other lectures that has kind of inspired out of that, and kind of some of the things that you're doing at the moment in terms of writing and studying and research?
Love to, Matthew, thanks. So back in going back 10 years and more, I was Provincial Grand Mentor for Derbyshire. And I suppose the start of that had been the PGM at the time had asked me to get involved in a little group he was setting up to look at lodge development. He was concerned that we had a number of struggling lodges and he wanted to do something about it. So I was part of a little group that worked on that. And out of that, he appointed me as the first Provincial Grand Mentor. So I became very interested in what went on in lodges and how those lodges supported new members. And what was it about lodges that members found attractive? You know, what worked, what didn't work? What were lodges doing when they were attracting and keeping members? And how was that different from lodges that were, you know, trying to bring people in but not keeping them? And so, you know, that developed into an approach to mentoring, which I, you know, introduced in Derbyshire. Mentoring was very new, and I joined with other provincial grand mentors around the country, who were brought together by James Bartlett, a great guy from Gloucestershire. But mentoring at the time was a good idea, but there was no substance. There was nothing underneath the surface. There was no process. And every province was writing its own sort of booklets and guidance and so forth. So the first thing that happened was I developed the Seven Habits talk, and that became very popular. It ended up being an article in the Square magazine in, I think, 2013. And from that, Lewis Masonic asked me to write a book based upon this idea of what works in lodges. How do you make a lodge successful in the 21st century? And so I started work on that. And around about the same time, I was asked to join a small working group underneath the what was then called the membership focus group. So the membership focus group had been set up by the program master to look at membership issues. And one of its little working groups was chaired by the Grand Secretary. And he put us, four or five of us together, and one of those was me. And I did a paper for that group. I'd been asked to look at recruitment. It's not a word I tend to use in Freemasonry, but that was the word we were using at the time. And, you know, how do organizations recruit our members? And so, you know, because I'd done the work on this in the Scouts, for the Scouts I'd written the book, and I was working as part of a team to do that, I was able to look at it through that. And I put a paper together that explained how we went about in Scouting recruiting adult members, adult volunteers. And I looked at one or two other, I brought some research up to date. And the conclusion I came to in the paper was that we should define a pathway into membership. And I put some suggestions forward on that. And that was taken up. The membership focus group asked me to develop that work and actually appointed me as a project manager to run a pilot study around 10 provinces. And all of this work, you're not working on your own. Although I've been the main author of the members pathway, I've always been part of a group. And I put a group together to help me develop the model. And then various people got involved in different aspects of the work. And so over the 6 years, there's been a number of different groups that have been working on this. And through those 6 years, you know, my main role has been the writer of it and bringing the research together and my experiences in organisations and so forth. So in parallel to that, I started writing other talks, you know, and Evolution and Change was one of the other ones. And that became quite big because the province of West Kent made it their Cornwallis lecture in 2018, and just like the Prestonian, it became one that I was invited around lots of provinces to deliver, and has really been quite significant from my point of view in getting a message across to both young brethren, or new brethren rather, and more experienced brethren, that says evolution is an important part of an organisation. If you want it to survive, if you want it to be strong and healthy, it has to evolve. And I prove that through examples and history and current examples. But I'm also speaking to more experienced Freemasons who are more nervous about change. And I'm saying to them, look, you know, actually, we've always changed and developed. This has always been part of our history. And so it's, you know, it's had a positive impact in that. And other talks have come out of it. The future of, Freemasonry, does it live up to expectations? Is all about the experience of Masons in their lodges, and whether lodges are satisfying those expectations, or whether, you know, one of the things I'm really concerned about is attempts to create a one-size-fits-all experience, which I really rail against. If there's one strong message I want to get across in some of my talks, is we cannot offer a one-size-fits-all experience. We can't say to new members, okay, you're now an entered apprentice, at the next meeting you've got to do this, and all entered apprentices do that. We've got to understand them as human beings, as individuals, with their own interests, wants, needs, circumstances, and we've got to treat people, you know, in a much more individualistic way. So all of these talks seem to sort of center around this idea of developing our membership, developing our lodges, but doing it with a better understanding of the working experience and lifestyle of the 21st century man.
On that then, Tony, how do you feel as though the present situation has affected the membership plan? And what would you say are the bigger challenges right now for lodges? And Certainly, is there anything that could be re-emphasised from that plan? And certainly your lectures, what do you see the bigger challenges being right now?
Thanks, Matt. Well, I think there are both risks and opportunities right now. The risk is that we will lose members not only through death, but for financial reasons, and in some cases, just simply through disengagement, through people not having any contact from their lodge, through people realizing that actually being at home with their family is quite nice, and just getting out of the habit. And all of those things are risks. But against that, we've got opportunities, and the opportunities are to find new ways to engage with our members, new ways to understand and get to know them, and to satisfy those needs. So, yeah, I'm a member of quite a few lodges. Some of those lodges are having regular Zoom meetings to either with, you know, some of them are very social, some of them are more structured. But one of the good things about it is that there's been a more personal connection between members as a result, and perhaps a better understanding of people as individuals, rather than just another entered apprentice, another fellow craft. I really hate the idea of new members being treated as elements on a conveyor belt. And we've got to get away from this conveyor belt thinking. And so I think there's a real opportunity because of the intimacy you get through this sort of meeting online through Zoom. You know, we're not wearing regalia. We're not sat in certain positions. We're not sat in a formal location in the lodge. And the opportunities, are there that many lodges are satisfying to get that better understanding. And some of those lodges, and indeed some of those provinces, are attracting more people to them. Some have got waiting lists of candidates wishing to join who've been attracted by the bond that they've seen in Freemasonry, by the work we've been doing in our communities, and by the openness that many brethren have got to say, well, you know, come on to one of our social Zoom meetings for my lodge, because there's that sense of brotherhood and fellowship, or whatever you want to, you know, fraternal link that we have, which they found quite infectious. So risks and opportunities, lodges that seize those opportunities and respond to those members' needs are going to do well out of this, are going to thrive. And although we can't meet in the full sense, you know, we can do other things. Let's not talk about what we can't do. Let's talk about what we can do and be more creative about it. And you guys fit in with this so well. What you're doing is, you're leaders in this. You're leading the way in terms of what a light blue club can do. But lodges have got to do it as well, because lodges are the membership unit. You know, that's how people have become Freemasons, through lodges. We have a bottom-up membership system. And unless our lodges look after their members and engage with them and satisfy those needs and expectations, those people won't stay members. I don't know whether, you know, you're also asking me my thoughts about restricted meetings. My view on that is our Grand Lodge could have said no meetings until next March or something, or, you know, end of the year or whatever. But I think by offering opportunities for lodges to meet within the restrictions mean that people have got choice. And I'm a great believer in giving people choice. I know not everybody's happy with that. I know there's a lot of talk by people, particularly on the Facebook channels, suggesting that Grand Lodge should have continued the suspension. But I think that deprives people of choice. And there are obviously lots of lodges where the members, where there's a large number of members who are low risk from coronavirus. And why should people like me who are at high risk, I've been shielding since March, I've not, you know, not gone out since March, but why should I, just because I'm a high risk, stop other guys who are a low risk from meeting? You know, providing their social distancing and taking proper precautions. So I'm a great believer in choice, and I'm a great believer in that responding to individual needs.
And what you've said very much touches on what I think we spoke about and the Grand Secretary's letter in Freemasonry Today that divided opinion, I think, particularly online.
I think so. I think we kind of highlighted it from this way, Tony. There's two obviously different spectrums, and I guess it's not a case of us and them, and that's something that we made quite clear. But I think it's something that we acknowledge that there's two schools of thought, depending on which end you sit on. And that is, if you're the ones that are keen to get back into it, then you need to have the patience, you need to have the, you know, the temperance, just to, you know, remind yourself that these things take time, and it'll take time to for things to change, to allow us sometimes to even meet as a lodge. And so patience is the key thing there. And I suppose kind of what you've just highlighted on as well, from the other side of it, for those who perhaps don't want to meet but don't want to miss out as well, we also kind of said, you know, flexibility is what we're asking for, you know, as well. And it's I guess it's in the sense that we're asking for things to change temporarily, so that our craft can continue as it always has. Even if it's not a permanent change, it still keeps the craft alive and it keeps it going. And it, you know, and that's what's important as well, I think. So I think every Freemason and probably to some extent in the world feels this way.
I feel like the quote was flexibility for the intolerant and tolerance for the inflexible.
I was going to say, whatever the outcome of this period, it's going to give future Prestonian lecturers a hell of a lot to write about.
I love the way, Matt, that you've taken it back to our principles and our values, you know, the four cardinal virtues and so forth, because I think it's really important that we use Freemasonry as a way to help us navigate through what is, for all of us, a completely different... Nobody's had an experience like this before. And for that reason, I struggle with the cause for people to create a sort of one-size-fits-all. I'm not in favour of a one-size-fits-all. You know, we want diversity in our lodges. We want diversity in the way in which we treat people. Our members are diverse. And people who are in employment at the moment, I hear the word flexibility. You used it there, Josh. They're being asked all the time at work to be flexible. And flexibility allows us to respond to the needs of our customers, our members, or whatever. And so I think flexibility is something that we've got to build into the Masonic experience. And so that, for me, informs the whole thing about the COVID thing. Let's not apply a one-size-fits-all and restrict everybody. Let's provide a framework in which, within the restrictions and within sensible practice, people can have the Masonic experience that they want. Now, I realise that some people struggle with that. I realise that if a lodge of mine is meeting and I can't get there, I feel that's hard. But I think there's ways that we can work with that. And I think there is opportunities there to involve people. And I think we've just got to work at being the best we can be and being the most tolerant we can be. But Freemasonry's got to learn to be more flexible. And it is learning through this to be more flexible. And we've got to, I firmly believe, we've got to recognise and work with that.
And we've obviously got new terms emerging, like hybrid meetings.
And some of this will carry forward. I mean, I don't expect to be travelling a long distance for a committee meeting in the future. What's the point? You know, why waste the petrol? Yeah. Why waste all the time? Yeah. You know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it's life balance.
Yeah. Let's use the face-to-face time for things that are really what we want to do face-to-face. So, let's build on the opportunities.
Corby was saying about in the 1920s, how we changed from the character ethic to the personality ethic. Do you think that the current situation in lockdown would help? Is maybe time repeating itself? And maybe are we returning to a character-based ethic with people focusing on what's more important to them rather than personality types?
Dino, that's a really good question. I think there's two things here. I think change accelerates as a result of crises, and you can get a paradigm shift, a sort of seismic shift in the way in which we do things. And that can apply to culture, it can apply to the mindset, can apply to how we operate, processes and procedures and so forth. And there is a potential for a paradigm shift here if we want it. the character ethic versus the person. I mean, just to briefly explain that to people who, this is all to do with our approach or understanding of personality, behavior, really, psychology. So character describes people's values or their qualities. So we talk about people being good listeners or, you know, or being kind and caring. Whereas personality is more concerned with behavior patterns. So, you know, you might describe people's personality as, you know, somebody's an extrovert or change resistant or, you know, easily stressed or whatever. The thing about the character ethic, you know, it sort of was built into Scouting's early days and Freemasonry's early days. And it has a lot of value because it sort of says these are things to be like, you know, these character types or these virtues or these qualities are things to emulate. And I guess that is built into Freemasonry, you know, the working tools, the four cardinal virtues all give us a framework to be better people. Whether or not the world at large will shift from the sort of personality, we use personality as a way to help understand how people behave. And a way to help predict future behavior. We use personality to help us select people for jobs and these sort of things. Whether the world will shift back to a character-based approach, I don't really know. I think Stephen Covey's had a big influence on things and it plays its part, but I don't see that. Whether or not Freemasonry will have a big shift, I think depends on whether or not, I think a lot comes back to the Book of Constitutions. So one of the things that has held Grand Lodge back from doing things differently has been that the Book of Constitutions requires meetings to take place in a certain way and certain things to happen or not happen. And the changes to the Book of Constitutions require two meetings of Grand Lodge. The March meeting was held. The June meeting was within the suspension. The September meeting was held with a small number of people in order to put forward some changes to the Book of Constitutions. But if we want more changes, they've got to be proposed in December and then voted on in March. So there's a time lag, but that time lag is a good opportunity to think about what we want in the future. And it's particularly an opportunity for lodges. And right back at the beginning of lockdown, I started putting up on Twitter, you know, are lodges using this time to reflect on what they do and how they work and their practices? Our lodge is using this time to think about the members' pathway. And step one in the members' pathway does ask lodges to stop and reflect and review and take stock and then plan for the future. So I would love to see lodges, you know, whatever anybody else does, I'd love to see more lodges use this time to really think about what they're doing, how they're doing it. Is it appealing? Is it bringing people in? Is it keeping people? Are there things we need to be changing? What are the things we want to carry forward in our lodges? What are the things we want to stop doing? What are the things we want to start doing? And having those conversations and using the members' pathway as a framework and using the tools in the members' pathway to help doing that, I think we've got the biggest opportunity we're probably going to have for years to come for lodges to really bring themselves up to date and say, this is how we want to go forward. And to any lodge, I'd say right now, I say to all members of all lodges, now is a good time to think in a sort of calm, reflective manner. What do we want this lodge to be in 10 years' time? You know, do we want it to be exactly the same? Do we see it as being the possibility of being something different, something stronger, something more vibrant, something that relates better to the membership, whatever? So if you could imagine yourself in a time machine, stepping in now and stepping out 10 years from now and looking around, you know, what would you want to see your lodge being doing? Now's a really good time to do that. When we start meeting in full again, we'll be going to be so busy catching up with stuff and initiating and learning ritual and doing this. Now's the time to really fix the roof and get it right and right for the future. So, yeah, I hope people take the opportunity. I'd like more and more to take the opportunity. Whether or not we'll see a paradigm shift, I don't really know. The Book of Constitutions is being rewritten as it happens, but not piecemeal. It will be a new Book of Constitutions that, you know, it'll be good if that introduces more flexibility. I'd like to see more flexibility for lodges so that they can do things in a way that's right for them, and so that they can create a more diverse range of lodges meeting the needs of a more diverse membership.
Thank you, Tony.
I can't help think of this from an IT sort of product manager and product lifecycle point of view.
Spot on.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you think about the change curve, if you think about the lifecycle of a product, and if you think about
I mean, lodges fit that. You know, a third of the old lodges that have been formed since 1717 have been closed. Now, that's not a failure. That means that they came up at a time, they met the needs at a time, they hit the sort of zeitgeist, as it were, but they did their thing and then they were perhaps replaced by something else, or in some cases they evolved and carried on. But if they hadn't evolved, then they wouldn't have done. So there is a natural cycle, a natural rhythm underneath evolution. So lodges can either work with that, you know, accept it and work with it and have a future, or they can resist it and die.
Thank you, Tony.
Tony, with your... talked about the Scouts and Masonry, bear in mind, like, when it comes to a lifespan and the opposite end of the spectrum, young to the elderly. So is there any parallels or any difference with where that they're both orders are adapting to the 21st century and with what's happened at the moment with COVID, i.e. with what you said earlier on about elder members resistant to change, scared of change? Those sort of changes would be easy for younger people in Scouts, i.e. Twitter, Facebook, that kind of thing. So in a nutshell, is there any differences or any parallels between both?
Thanks, Andy. I think it's important to understand that Scouting, although it exists for the benefit of young people, the membership includes people of all ages, you know, from six upwards. So we've got many adults in Scouting who've given many, many years of, you know, service. I've been an adult in Scouting for more than 35 years. So our membership, like the membership of Freemasonry, embraces adults of all ages. And therefore, we do have, you're quite right, we do have similar challenges in terms of managing or navigating change and keeping things fresh. Because it's a youth organisation, I guess Scouting is very well tuned into the need for change and the need to keep things fresh and the need to rebrand some, you know, and change the program and step up perhaps more frequently. And Freemasonry is typically quite, you know, cautious. We're taught to be cautious. And so the pace of change and the acceptance of change is perhaps more difficult there. My view about people's reactions or responses to change comes back to the idea of we're all different. And I don't subscribe to the idea that everybody fears change or everybody doesn't like change. A lot of people embrace change and are quite enthusiastic about it. What I do think is that a lot of people struggle with change because they fear they're going to lose something. It's not change that people fear, it's loss. And I think that's part of our challenge in Freemasonry and in Scouting, that when we're thinking about change and how we evolve things so that they're, a term I use a lot, fit for the future, we need to take people with us and we need to involve people in that process. And we need to make sure that they feel part of it and they're still wanted and able to contribute. So I get really concerned if long-serving members in the craft, say, feel disenfranchised from their lodges, you know, because of things that have happened. I think we need to involve everybody. And quite often the people who are most vocal about these things are people who've been involved in changes themselves, but years before. And so building on those experiences and involving them, I think, is really, really important. Now, we've learned a lot of that through Scouting. You know, we've been through big changes in Scouting. We've been through seismic change, paradigm shifts in Scouting at least twice. And we've learned a lot of lessons there. And I think they're lessons that Freemasonry can also learn as Freemasonry learns to manage change better. Now, a lot of our lodges are doing this really well. There's a real vibrancy amongst a lot of lodges. And it's great to see. And that's what gives me the confidence that Freemasonry will endure. Because, you know, we clearly have lodges that are able to do that. But equally, there are lodges that won't be able to because they don't, or they haven't learned or accepted the lessons, or accepted the need for change and learned the lessons.
Thank you.
So we've spoken a bit about the membership pathway, but let's expand on that a little bit more then of where that's come from and what your involvement's been in that.
Yeah, thank you, Matt. So I mentioned earlier that I'd been on this working group at Grand Lodge and I did this paper and I suggested this idea of a pathway into membership. And the concept really was to provide lodges with a toolkit which they could use to manage the journey into Freemasonry. So it was looking at the members' experience and creating an experience for applicants for Freemasonry and new members. And we talk about it actually all the way through from before even thinking about Freemasonry, all the way through to being introduced, being initiated, all the way through to being a committed Master Mason. So what we want is people who join Freemasonry and find what they want in it and remain committed members. And so the approach, I worked with a small group of people to map out that journey, and it's now in 11 steps. The journey looks at how do we start as a lodge to get ourselves ready for this. So instead of just launching into how do we find new members, let's start by getting the lodge, and there's that phrase again, fit for the future. Let's start by getting the lodge ready to have new members. And the reason that's so important is that it's no good bringing in new members into a lodge that is dysfunctional or is incapable of satisfying their needs. We know that our resignations are too high. One of the key bits of data at the time was that one in five new members, one in five initiates, did not stay in membership long enough to collect their Grand Lodge certificate. They'd resigned before then. So that was a key thing to bring down. And the concept, therefore, of the members' pathway was, instead of looking at it from a top-down campaign thing, looking at it from a bottom-up approach. What is it that lodges can do in order to create that good experience all the way through and to manage the journey into Freemasonry? Now, I've mentioned my academic background in psychology. Professionally, I work in organizational development and leadership and change. So I've got a lot of background to bring to that, a lot of good practice to bring to that. And was able to write. I've been the main author that has put this material together, working with other people who've done other aspects of the work. So we piloted it with 10 provinces. That pilot was really focused on what happens around the interview. And part of that was completely changing the interview experience, rather than it being a big board of all the past masters or the committee or whatever, turning it into a more structured, more planned approach with three skilled interviewers. And lodges that have adopted this have found that the interview is much more worthwhile and able to help them distinguish between people who would be good for the lodge and people who wouldn't be so good for the lodge. The pilot study went very well, was very successful. The work to develop the rest of the steps went on in parallel to that. And we were then able to launch it. It was accepted by all the provincial grandmasters in October 2017. We launched it through a series of regional workshops around the country in early 2018. We've held two membership conferences for membership officers and mentors. And it's now, the work that's going on now is to make the materials more accessible, to break them down into and make them more attractive. They're very word heavy at the moment. So the work, people tell us that the words are fine, which is nice and good and reassuring. And, you know, what it tells us to do works, but we need to make the materials more attractive. And that's what the work that's going on at the moment. And to get it to more and more lodges.
Forgive my inexperience of the pathway, because I obviously came through before the pathway. But essentially, does that carry on after someone's actually got their Grand Lodge certificate?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So it's a full life cycle, essentially, to manage someone's Masonic career going forward.
Yeah, up to a point. We've always said up to being a committed Master Mason. Now, that's not defined in terms of numbers. It's really defined in terms of the quality of the experience and the involvement. So, you know, if we go back to the idea of individuals on their own journey and the individuals having their own expectations, some people want to be heavily involved and other people want to be less involved. So as long as they continue their the involvement that they want, that's where the pathway takes us. What it doesn't do, and just to break that down a bit more, Dino, step eight is all about mentoring, and it's the early stages of mentoring. Step nine is about introducing the Royal Arch. And we know, for example, that people who join the Royal Arch tend to become more committed to Freemasonry as a whole. It enriches their Masonic experience. And of course, the Royal Arch is very, very connected to the craft in English Freemasonry. Step 10 is effectively continued mentoring. It's mentoring beyond those immediate years, beyond the 3 degrees. It's how we continue to support people as they take office and progress through the lodge. I've always thought that there's a next phase, which is sort of preparing for the chair and beyond. But that work hasn't been done yet. It's there as a concept. I don't think it's likely to happen immediately, because I think there's still a lot of work to do to encourage more lodges to embrace the members' pathway and adopt it and use it. And incidentally, it's the members' pathway. because it's focused on the members themselves rather than a sort of remote concept. So I always try to use that term, the members pathway, not the individual members, but collective members.
And Tony, where can lodges get that if they don't currently have a copy?
Okay, so it's published digitally, and the website is b.ugle.org.uk/membership. And that website will take you to a series of tiles where you can find the material at the level or the depth that you want. There's some role profiles there as well for lodge mentors and so forth, lodge membership officers. But it also takes you through the stages. The members pathway works in three levels. There's the top level is sort of why we want it, what's it all about. The next level is about what to do. And the bottom level is about how to do it. So people who are very involved in managing in organisations might not need the bottom level. They'll work it out for themselves. They know how to interview. They know how to survey. They know how to, you know, get consensus in a lodge, or they know how to do a review or a plan or whatever. The middle level is really, really important because it takes us through step by step the things to do that we know work because they're tried and tested. And one of the real good things is that it's expanding, because the more we can bring good practice in, the more lodges tell us, well, we did this and this is how we went about it. And these are the results we got. The more we can capture of that, the better. It's not procedural. So we've not changed any of the rules. Well, there have been changes to the rules that have come about it, but they're not built into the pathway. They're left in the Book of Constitutions. So the members pathway is a guide into good practice.
Brethren, before we go any further, I'd like to call upon Brother Josh.
The hands are square, brethren, and so we are going to take a moment to remember absent brethren. To absent brethren.
To absent brethren.
Absent brethren.
Absent brethren. Absent brethren.
Okay, so Tony, you were talking about the three different levels, and we were talking about the middle level. What comes after that?
So the middle level is really a guide as to what to do. But all the materials have got links into further depths. So if you, for example, want to go from the middle level, what, into, well, how do I do that? That's all very well telling me do this, but how? I don't know how to do it. And so the link will take you down into a good practice document or a support document that will give you much more in-depth guidance as to how to go about doing something. So there's some really good material in there, for example, on interviewing, or, you know, how to decide the result of an interview. There's some good in-depth material in there on how to mentor. You know, what does a mentor really do? I said earlier that we didn't have a lot of structure around mentoring in its early days. It was a good concept. It was a set of principles, but there was no framework for it. There were no processes. The members pathway now does that. So the members pathway is also, if you like, providing Grand Lodge's toolkit for mentoring. It's embracing the whole of the how to do mentoring bit.
Excellent. Thank you. And so, Tony, one thing that we are aware of is, as well as being a very competent and worldly lecturer, you're also now taking your hand to become a scholar. So there's a new book coming out, isn't there? So tell us a bit more about that, and when can we expect it?
Thank you, Matt. Well, yeah, I've written a few books, some in my business life and some in my Masonic. The book was really triggered by my Seven Habits talk and started its first life back in 2014, I think, when I was asked to expand that talk into a book. And I paused it in order to develop the members pathway. But lockdown and COVID and so forth is really giving me more time to turn my attention back to the book. And of course, now I've got lots of other talks which I can build into it. So the book is, or will be, all about managing lodges in the 21st century. There is only working titles flying around at the moment, but essentially what it will do is it will look at the seven habits. It will probably start with the seven habits. It will look at membership data. You know, a lot of people talk about good ideas, but they don't back it up with evidence. They don't back it up with data. So I've compiled lots of different membership related data, and that will form a sort of evidence base for the rest of the book. One of the big chapters is going to be all about individual expectations and how we can identify those and work with those so that we build our lodges around its individual members and their needs. Other chapters will bring in the evolution and change talk and managing change, handling resistance, and other elements of different talks that I've been working on. I envisage a chapter on the psychology of mentoring, And it won't be an academic, you know, when I say the psychology, it probably won't be called that. It will be more accessible than that. It won't be academic in any way, but it will be all about understanding the basis of mentoring, why mentoring is an important process and what mentoring is trying to achieve on an individual level. You know, I've got it all mapped out. I know exactly how it's going to be structured. I'm about 15,000 words in at the moment. And a lot of it will be rewriting talks into a format and with a voice that sits well with a book. It will be quite accessible. It won't be heavy going. It will be written for all of us to use. And I hope that what it will become is a sort of guidebook for evolving lodges and managing membership for the future. It will make a lot of references to, you know, to the members pathway. You know, I see it as sitting alongside the members pathway, really. The members pathway will continue to evolve. The book will be making the case for lodges to manage themselves in a way that allows them to grow and thrive in the 21st century, for the 21st century working man.
I really took the managing expectations talk you did on board. And one of the things I found myself having to do recently is apologise to my other half, because I've got angry with her because I've set an expectation in my head without verbalising that.
Like, oh, I know that one.
Yeah. Yesterday, you know, I was talking to me, Dino, my other half, went to a pub to watch the football, and I had to run out for half an hour beforehand, and I just assumed she would get ready, because we had to go shortly thereafter. I just assumed she would get ready, and then got home, realised she wasn't. And I wasn't, you know, I wasn't angry, but I was a bit terse. And yeah, I just found myself having to, no, I made this expectation unrealistically, didn't confirm it, didn't, you know, didn't speak to her about it, didn't manage that at all. And then have to, you know, take a step back outside myself and realise, no, I've set unrealistic expectations there, I've not managed it properly and have to apologise. So yeah, you know, it's something that applies to both lodges and to us personally.
Sorry, we sort of live in our private world, don't we, our headspace, you know, our self-talk, and we live in a public space where we're connecting with other people, and sometimes we may have a sort of inner dialogue, you know, I've got to do this, you know, okay, I'll do this first, forgetting that other people can't hear that. So yeah, that makes absolute sense. But again, you know, I'm really quite humbled, Josh, that the talk has you know, given you something to help you process that and work with that and so forth. I that expectations talk, it's perhaps not one of the sexiest titles, or one of the you know, it doesn't seem to be on demand as much as others, but I think it's a core building block in the whole principle of us as a membership organization. I'm talking about our lodges, membership units, our lodges, understanding that everybody's different and people come in wanting different things, looking for different things, and how we satisfy those expectations. And it, you know, for small lodges, it's really difficult, because a lodge is a big infrastructure. We've got a lot of offices. We want to fill those offices. And if we're a small lodge, we almost expect every new member to get straight involved. And for some people, that's too much too soon. For other people, it's great, you know.
The managing expectations lecture that you did for us previously, I personally also found it really, really impacting, both on myself and generally. And it gives you a lot to think about, because obviously managing those expectations is kind of the key to the whole retention piece. But it's also about the exploratory stage as well. Like I think you mentioned in the lecture that kind of you've also got to manage your expectations of managing your expectations. You've got to understand what the individual's expectations are before. You can't presume. And sometimes you might think you're coming in from a great perspective of wanting to manage the expectations and completely presuming what those individuals' expectations are. So from that perspective, that's had impact on me personally, as well as professionally through Masonry as well. And so I've always appreciated that lecture.
Thank you.
In the military, we always had a saying which said, assumptions, you know, don't assume anything, because it makes an ass of you and an ass of me.
Absolutely. But it's really important here to understand that people join Freemasonry for different reasons. And each of those reasons trigger expect. And there are 9 different reasons that have been identified for people joining Freemasonry. John Roscoe did some great work on this. But it's not only the reasons for joining, it's what you want from the experience. You know, do you want to be a driver or a passenger? some external research into membership organisations, nothing to do with Freemasonry, although Freemasonry is part of it, shows that 20% of members of membership organisations want to get involved in running it. Now, if you're a small lodge, you need more than 20% of your members to get involved in running it. So if you put that burden on everybody, you're going to, you know, and we know that's the reason some people leave, because there's too much pressure put on too soon or at the wrong time in their life.
Conversely as well, sometimes I know that people do want to get involved.
Yeah.
And people have said, slow down. There's no need. You can hold back. And so from another point of view, especially in this situation where we're all stuck in, we've got quite a few young Masons who actually actively want to do something. And
yeah,
frustrated for the simple fact that, no, we can't. And it's no one's fault. But, you know, when people do want to get ahead and do want to do something. And this is why, from my perspective, the Light Blues clubs have been setting up lectures, doing Zoom calls, having quizzes, setting up podcasts, things like that. So it's just a way for us to express our enthusiasm, really.
Absolutely.
On the back of that, we all know the story of the two bulls, don't we?
Which story? Go on.
Two bulls in a field.
Could let the listeners Google that one.
Yeah, that might be smarter.
Well, it's, you know, we were talking earlier about mindsets, you know, and the one-size-fits-all mindset. So there's this sort of this strong ethic of the wise Mason saying to the new Mason, you know, take your time, don't rush things and so forth. But actually, you know, Dino, you're right. Some people want to process things in a different way. And, you know, they can grasp something intellectually or it resonates with them at a different level, at a different pace. So one of the things about mentoring is mentoring people at the pace they want to go, not the pace you want them to go. And mentoring isn't about instruction. It's not telling people what we want them to know. You know, it's not about saying, well, the first thing you've got to learn is the working tools. Mentoring is about listening to people's questions and giving them the information they want at the pace they want it, in the manner they want it, and giving them the support and encouragement in the manner they want it. So it really is about tuning into the individual. And this is where I think we've got to learn to be more individually focused and more flexible in the way we do these things. And it's a lodge level that we've got to learn these things.
Definitely looking forward to reading this book, Tony.
And I better write it, hadn't I?
Well, yeah. I think it'd make a fantastic gift for any new worshipful master going into the chair and, you know, things like that, just to give them an opportunity to read and kind of expand their thought process on how they want to approach the lodge. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to that being published. And I'm assuming that's going to be on Lewis Masonic's website.
Well, I'm talking with Lewis, although we've not formally set up contract. We did do a few years ago. And I, as I said, we pressed the pause. But, you know, that's what I expect is going. Lewis are very keen on it. But we've just got to thrash out those details. But in the meantime, I'm getting on and writing it.
Brilliant. Look forward to it.
Yeah, thank you.
Fantastic. Well, Tony, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on. Wish for brother Tony Harvey, the 2012 Bristolian lecturer, the man, the myth, the legend. And you can go check out his YouTube channel, Wish for Brother Tony Harvey. Go check it out. Go subscribe. Go check out some of his lectures and his material that are on there.
Thank you. And if people would like to look at my website as well, prestonian2012.org.uk, you can sign up there as well to receive my updates. But Matt and team, thank you so much for inviting me. This has been a great pleasure. I've had real fun. And every time I've done some stuff with you, I've come away energized and enthused. The work you're doing is fantastic. It's inspirational. It's taking us forward. And most importantly, it's keeping our new and young members engaged with Freemasonry in such a good way. So thank you for everything you guys are doing.
Thank you, Tony. We really appreciate that.
Cheers, Johnny.
Johnny, it'd be remiss of us if we didn't say once the rule of six becomes the rule of 12, you know, once the lockdown and is settled down, you're more than welcome up to Leeds anytime, Tony.
Thank you. It's going to be a while before I'm able to take you up on that because I'm still shielding. So I'm because of a medical condition, I'm in that category which is likely to be, you know, very cautious and not come out of our hobbit holes until we're, you know, there's a medical solution. But It's not about when. It's a, you know, I'm definitely going to come up and see you guys. And awesome. You know, when you get your lodge going, oh, count me in. I'm looking forward to being able to visit you there.
Fantastic. So,
thank you.
Awesome. Well, I have been your host, Brother Matt Namiria.
I still am, Brother Josh Doherty Turnbull.
I'm always Brother Matthew Wharton.
Your humble servant, Brother Dean Leach.
The day I was born to the day I die was your Brother Andrew Polviak.
And it's been a great pleasure to be able to take part with you guys. Tony Harvey, thank you very much.
Good night, brethren.